that you too can be a voice for the animals.
This program was produced at KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. More audio is available online at kboo.fm.
Hi, this is Peter Himmelman. You're listening to KBOO Community Radio 90.7 FM.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 33rd Annual Cascade Festival of African Films, starting Friday, February 3rd, until Saturday, March 4th. Screenings will take place every Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, bringing live interviews with filmmakers, community conversations, and more. Films will be screened at PCC Cascade, Hollywood Theater, and virtually. Full schedule and location information can be found at africanfilmfestival.org. That's the 33rd Annual Cascade Festival of African Films, happening throughout the month of February in celebration of Black History Month. Full schedule and location information can be found at africanfilmfestival.org.
Good morning and welcome to Film at 11 here on your community radio, KBOO Portland. This week, Matthew of KBOO's bedtime story show Gremlin Time looks at the horror film The Bat with Vincent Price, recently released on DVD. And in the book corner, we look at a great new book on the films of Preston Sturges. But first, Jeff Godsell evaluates Paul Newman in HUD.
You don't have to be a staunch defender of the auteur theory of film criticism to appreciate that the best movies are made by the best directors. I even happen to agree with whoever said that they would rather watch the worst movie by a Hitchcock or a Scorsese than the best movie by a hack. I could pass on the entire careers of a Jack Smite or a Joel Schumacher. But neither do I want to fall into the cult of the master director, presuming that only an anointed few can make anything of merit. That's why I am always gratified to find a truly terrific film directed by someone not usually spoken of with great reverence by cinephiles. Someone maybe not even mentioned in Andrew Saris's The American Cinema. Martin Ritt had a long and successful career as a filmmaker from 1957 until his death in 1990. Like the better-known Sidney Lumet, Ritt made a lot of socially conscious films and was considered an actor's director, working with some of the biggest names in Hollywood, five times with Paul Newman, but none of them better than HUD from 1960.
It turned you sour on me, not that I give a damn.
You don't care about people, HUD. You don't give a damn about them.
Granddad?
You live just for yourself, and that makes you not fit to live with.
Based on a novel by Larry McMurtry, the story is set in a small town in West Texas where rancher Homer Bannon has a problem. One of his cattle has died inexplicably. The elderly and principled Bannon, played by Melvin Douglas, knows that the right thing to do is to send for the state veterinarian. The cow might have contracted foot and mouth disease, potentially threatening all the cattle in the region. Bannon's hot-headed and self-centered son, HUD, however, isn't too keen on the idea. But then he wouldn't be. As we learn throughout the course of the film, doing the right thing is not HUD's usual plan of action. As for the law, HUD tends to take a lenient approach. "Sometimes I lean one way, sometimes the other," he says. HUD would rather sell off the rest of the cattle to unsuspecting ranchers before the news spreads. And he further blames his father for buying the cheap Mexican cattle in the first place. There is no love lost between father and son, and just how far back this goes is one of the deep plot points in HUD. There have been characters lacking in a moral compass in theater and films before, but you'd be hard-pressed to find one more amoral or the center of attention than in Hud. It's all the more fascinating considering that Hud is played by Paul Newman, perhaps at his most charismatic, as his star was continuing to rise from films like The Hustler. You can't take your eyes off him. He gets his way with the ladies, even the married ones, and the men tip their hats to him in this dusty Texas town. The character of Hud was emphasized from what was a more minor character in the original novel by Newman and director Martin Ritt when they developed the project for their new production company, Salem Productions. Much to their credit, there are no redeeming qualities allowed to creep into Hud's character to make him more palatable to the audience. But he remains enigmatic even after a kind of reveal when the two men confront what Hud at least thought was the source of their animosity. And I won't reveal here just what that is. Locked in the middle of the animosity between the two men is Lonnie, played by Brandon DeWilde, Hud's teenage nephew, Homer's grandson from his other deceased son. Lonnie's a good kid. He loves his grandfather, but he can't help but look up to his Uncle Hud, wild as he is. Rounding out the group is Alma, the housekeeper, played by Patricia Neal in her deservedly Oscar-winning role. Alma takes care of all three of them and can hold her own with any man. She's down to earth and still has her charms, which don't go unnoticed by either Hud or Lonnie. There's a tenderness between Alma and the young Lonnie, contrasted with the often crudeness of Hud. Alma admits her attraction to Hud. "The sight of you through the window with your shirt off got me to put my dish towel down more than once," she says. But she knows his type. She's been mistreated before, so she keeps her distance. The wonderful interplay between these characters plays out among the backdrop of the plight of the cattle. The state vet does come out, takes some tests, and quarantines the entire ranch, awaiting the results. In the meantime, Hud sees a lawyer, looking for some way to seize control of the ranch, maybe by claiming Homer to be incompetent. Things go from bad to worse when the tests come back positive for foot and mouth disease. The entire herd must be killed and buried on the ranch to prevent the spread of the disease. This sets up one of Hud's most memorable scenes. Hud was shot on location in the Texas Panhandle in widescreen and black and white by the great veteran cinematographer James Wong Howe. You can just feel the dust of the outdoors and sense the claustrophobic interiors of the slowly decaying little town. Brings to mind another adaptation of a Larry McMurtry novel a few years later, The Last Picture Show. The drama of Hud plays out almost like a Greek tragedy, but with a twist. The old man dies of a heart attack. Alma takes the first bus out after an attempted rape by a drunken Hud. And even Lonnie leaves after seeing enough of Hud's true colors. Left alone but with control of the ranch, Hud ambles into the house from the back porch, cracks open a beer, looks around. And in one of those great last shots that we love in the movies, he merely shrugs as the screen door slams and we fade to that logo of the Paramount Mountain on the end title. True to their types, the Paramount execs didn't like the film on its completion, feeling it was too dark and not commercial. They even considered dropping it or changing the ending before director Ritt flew to New York and convinced them otherwise. Hud was, nevertheless, a critical and commercial success, acclaimed at the Venice Film Festival and getting 7 Oscar nominations. In addition to Patricia Neal winning, Melvin Douglas and James Wong Howe all took home trophies. Hud is currently available for streaming on Canopy and Hoopla, as well as on DVD. This is Jeff Godsell for Essentials of Cinema. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Jeff. And don't forget to visit Jeff's website, Essentials of Cinema, for more recommendations. And you are listening to Film at 11 here on Community Radio KBOO Portland. Please think about becoming a member today. Next, here's Matthew of KBOO's Gremlin Time with some thoughts on the Vincent Price, Agnes Moorehead thriller, The Bat.
Come in. Come closer. That's right. I'm Vincent Price. You'll be just as safe in this house of fear as any of the other five victims murdered by the Bat.
This film came out in 1959, and at that time it would be double billed in theaters with the Hammer film, The Mummy.
In all of the annals of mystery, there's never been a more elusive, fearsome, and cunning killer. He'll lure you through hidden passages to make you his next victim. But nobody lives forever, so why be afraid of the Bat?
Recently released from the good folks at The Film Detective is a nice restoration of this 1959 thriller, The Bat. And this features some very nice extras on it and comes in both a DVD and Blu-ray. Besides the movie, you've got some a great commentary track by Jason A. Nye, and there's also a little booklet on some more information about this film. And he points out that this is not like a hidden gem. A few weeks ago, I talked about The Tall Target with Dick Powell and directed by Anthony Mann. Now, that was a hidden gem. This is just a very solid programmer put together by good professionals. It's not like one of those movies that are so bad they're good. And Nye points that out. Like, you take a movie like, say, Robot Monster or Teenagers from Outer Space or Bride of the Monster, and those movies have a sort of ineptitude, but they have a sort of earnestness that makes them sort of fascinating to look at. In this case, the script is just a little underdone. And the director and the cast do their best, and especially the cinematography is very good in this. But it's still a kind of a weak script in that you kind of have to be in the right mood to sort of appreciate The Bat.
How long has he been dead?
Oh, I'd say about a half an hour. Do you believe it was The Bat?
That's a Bat's trademark.
Perhaps he's still in the house.
That's possible.
It says here that the Bat never leaves no fingerprints.
That's understandable. Having no face, he probably has no fingers either.
Now, even though Vincent Price is kind of headlined in this, the real star of this movie is Agnes Moorehead. And here she'd been in the movies for over 15 years, and this is the first time that she was offered a lead role in any movie, which kind of explains why she took the role in this movie. So in this, she plays Cornelia Van Gorder, and she is a mystery writer, and she's moved into this old house, and the plot begins to sound like an episode of Murder, She Wrote, because there's like been a bank robbery, and there's money hidden in the house, and there's this serial killer, the Bat, who's running around the neighborhood, and it all gets mixed up, and it sounds really cliche, but that's mainly because the original source novel of this, The Spiral Staircase, written by Mary Richard Reinhardt, which came out in 1908, and she later adapted it into a very popular play. And then it became in the movies in 1920s. And this is about the fourth adaptation of this very popular and influential work. The Old Dark House is the sort of the name of the subgenre that this established. You've got this isolated house and these characters assembled, and there's murder and mystery, and maybe there's some supernatural intrigue going on. And Vincent Price had seen the play and thought it was very good and was disappointed with the script in this particular movie, that it didn't quite live up to as intense the original production was.
Now you take one of those tablets I left for you, and I'll guarantee you a good night, and I'll drop in on you tomorrow.
Oh, thanks for everything, Doctor.
Now don't worry, I can find my way out.
Oh, I know you can, but do let me help you.
Oh,
Don't forget that once I'm gone, you'll have to climb those stairs alone.
Oh, I'm all right. I'm armed now.
Can you shoot one of those things without shutting your eyes?
Oh, Doctor, there are guns in every book I've ever written. I don't write about things I'm unfamiliar with. Lock the door, Lizzie.
Good night.
Yes, ma'am. Good night, Doctor.
Did you know that young Mark Fleming leased you this house without notifying his uncle?
No, I didn't.
Well, it doesn't matter now. John Fleming is dead and Mark's his heir. But if John were alive, he would warn you to leave here, Miss Van Gorder.
Really?
Yes. It's been a tragic place for anyone who ever lived in it. Well, good night.
Good night, Doctor.
Who's out there?
Nobody you need worry about, Doctor.
Oh, it's Andy.
Oh.
That's right. Oh, good evening, Miss Van Gorder.
Good evening, Lieutenant.
Is somebody sick here?
My maid was bitten by a bat.
A rabid bat?
Well, I'll know for sure when I get to my lab. I caught the bat.
It happened indoors?
In my bedroom, yes.
How'd it get in?
Well, there are many ways a bat could get in a house.
You ought to know. I spotted this hole in the window the minute I got here.
Why?
That's where the two-legged bat got your door open.
Miss Van Gorder told me that she phoned headquarters at Zenith.
Yes, I phoned twice. The second time was after the prowler got in the house.
Weren't you at headquarters, Andy?
No, but they contacted me.
An officer came and searched the house from top to bottom, but they couldn't find the bat.
You better have this window fixed tomorrow.
Oh, yes, I certainly shall.
Well, as you can tell from this clip, the main problem with the movie is things are talked about and explained instead of being shown. Which is sort of the main problem with the script. Otherwise, everything is really good in this. The pace is well kept up, and especially the cinematography by Joseph Bayrock, who's done a number of really great movies, like Uzana's Raid and Brian's Song, which he would do long after this. He did Tony Rome, did episodes of Man from U.N.C.L.E. on TV, as well as My Friend Flicka and The Thin Man with Peter Lawford. He was also the cinematographer on It's a Wonderful Life. And so this movie has a good look to it. Like, things don't get flat, as can happen in a low-budget film. And I think maybe that was the problem with the movie. There probably just wasn't enough time or money to do one more rewrite of the script to clear up, some of the problems in the plot. There's, like, a point where we're supposed to be afraid that the man's breaking into the house, but it's like the women are talking on the phone and the guy's kind of like waving at him from outside the window. It's just very weird things like that. But overall, everything moves really well. It's kind of a shame that no one ever picked up on Agnes Moorehead in this sort of role as a sort of female detective like this, as would later be done with Murder, She Wrote. As I said, this is from the original source novel by Mary Richards Reinhardt, who was really an inspiration to Agatha Christie in her writing. You could say that Mary Richards Reinhardt is to Agatha Christie as, say, Little Richard and Chuck Berry are to the Beatles. So it's kind of that. So in that way, there's a lot of interesting stuff about this movie that is included in this disc from The Film Detective, a good commentary track, a companion essay with lots of background on this very interesting director, Crane Wilbur, who began in the movies in like 1915 as a co-star with Pearl White in The Adventures of the Perils of Pauline. And he's doing stunts and they're hanging off of buildings and all this stuff. And then he became a writer. And he was involved in a lot of interesting projects which are worth looking into, which makes this really a nice set. A movie that's really kind of average. It probably would have been like a made-for-TV movie a couple of years later. So that's The Bat from The Film Detectives, starring Agnes Moorehead and Vincent Price.
Thanks, Matthew. Finally, here is a look at the new film-by-film survey of Preston Sturges' work by Stuart Clowens of The Nation and published by Columbia University Press.
Oh, go on, lady. Tell us some more.
Well, when I arrived in New York, I wanted to find Uncle Alfred, of course, but I didn't know where he was All I could remember was that he had said Connecticut.
Good evening, Sir Alfred.
Oh, Horace, old boy, I want you to meet my niece, Lady Eve Sidwich.
How are you, Lady Sidwich?
This is Mr. Pike Eve, Mr. Horace Pike, our host.
How'd you do?
My niece was telling a rather an amusing incident, Horace.
Well, go on, please.
Thank you. Now, where was I?
You didn't know where Connecticut was.
Oh, yes. So I took the tube.
The tube?
The subway, old boy.
Yes, and to the official I said, be so good as to let me off at Connecticut. So he said, lady, I don't know where Connecticut is, but this train goes to Harlem. But I don't know how he knew I was a lady. Oh,
about 20 years ago, a book came out called Film as Philosophy, Essays in Cinema After Wittgenstein and Cavell, edited by Rupert Reed and Jerry Goodnow. The Cavell of the title is Stanley, the late philosopher who specialized in cinema. Arguably, his most known work is Pursuits of Happiness, in which he looks at a genre of screwball comedies he called comedies of remarriage. Among the 9 guest writers in this anthology is Stuart Clowens, with an essay called Habitual Remarriage, The Ends of Happiness in the Palm Beach Story, which asks a simple question and comes up with a detailed and nuanced answer. Why didn't Stanley Cavell include Preston Sturges' film, The Palm Beach Story, in his book about the comedies of remarriage? The essay was our first awareness that Stuart Clowens would prove to be an authority on Preston Sturges. Preston Sturges, 1898 to 1959, as an AI writing machine would put it, was an American screenwriter, playwright, and film director during the 40s. He is considered one of the most important figures in the history of American comedy and is known for his witty and fast-paced dialogue, as well as his ability to blend comedy with drama. Some of his notable films include The Great McGinty, The Lady Eve, and Sullivan's Travels. The general outlines of the career of Preston Sturges are well known to most film students. From a childhood surrounded by businessmen and European artists, Sturges eventually wrote a hit Broadway play, ending up in Hollywood writing screenplays, bouncing from studio to studio, until he ended up at Paramount, home of Lubitsch and Wilder. He had also studied the making of his earlier film, The Power and the Glory, a movie that anticipated both Citizen Kane and Pulp Fiction, and realized that he wanted to write his films for sole credit and then direct them. Eventually he did at Paramount, making a run of comedy masterpieces. Now Stuart Clowens has published a whole book that looks at those Paramount films one by one and offers up fresh insights into how they work. After he left Paramount, Sturges fell off the map. He spent a decade in the wilderness, forgotten by film writers and viewers alike, except for people such as Andrew Saris, who interviewed him at the Plaza Hotel in 1957. He died 2 years later. Stuart Clowens is a film critic who has written for The Nation magazine, and his new book, Crooked But Not Common, The Films of Preston Sturges from Columbia University Press, examines these films. In general, the book explores the themes, techniques, and influences that made Sturges' work unique and enduring and provides a deeper understanding of his place in the history of American cinema. Each essay in the book focuses on a particular aspect of one of Sturges' films. This approach allows the reader to gain a deeper understanding of the unique style and techniques that Sturges used. For example, The Great McGinty raises the interesting notion of the use of names in the films, and how in this case, Dan McGinty may not even be the character's real name, but instead made up to make him a more viable political candidate. This is a tale filled with what Clowens calls Sturges' roughhouse glee, but it is also subtle about intimate relationships, such as the arranged marriage meant to make McGinty sellable to women voters. Clowens writes, quote, but given Muriel Angeles's, she's the one who plays the wife, habit of keeping her lips breathlessly parted at all times and emitting a gasp at the end of each line, Catherine comes across from the first as being aroused by McGinty. Little wonder that when the couple at last consummate their marriage, after months of supposedly sexless cohabitation, they give the impression of tumbling into a union expressly forbidden by the production code. Their wedding, though lawful, had been fake. The lust looks real. By the way, Clowens correctly identifies the William Demarest character in this film correctly as a ward healer. Few other writers have characterized him correctly. The author is also insightful about Sturgis's second directorial effort. Quote, alone among Sturgis's films, Christmas in July is about the public use of words. His other films are as crammed as a fruitcake with boozy plums of political oratory, movie studio puffery, legal double talk, gossip column innuendo, and editorial page pomposities. Only in Christmas in July, though, does the whole action turn on a phrase invented for a corporation's billboards and radio broadcasts. That phrase is, if you can't sleep at night, it's not the coffee, it's the bunk. In as many iterations, most of them garbled, Jimmy's slogan for Maxford House Coffee is the movie. A play of illusions, a tissue of misunderstandings, a sequence of words that might initially sound like they make sense but don't, or that maddeningly make no sense but almost bring an idea into focus. Close quote. With The Lady Eve, Clowens explores why Sturgis pressed a biblical text into the foreground of The Lady Eve and then made its meaning obscure. Here is his take on Barbara Stanwyck watching Henry Fonda in her pocket mirror as numerous women on an ocean liner try to get his attention, calling it a film within the film.
Every Jane in the room is giving him the thermometer and he feels they're just a waste of time. He's returning to his book. He's deeply immersed in it. He sees no one except... Watch his head turn when that kid goes by.
Won't do you any good, dear. He's a bookworm, but swing him anyway.
Oh, now how about this one?
How would you like that hanging on your Christmas tree?
Oh, you wouldn't?
Well, what is your weakness, brother? Holy smoke, the drop kerchief. That hasn't been used since Lily Langtry. You'll have to pick it up yourself, madam. It's a shame. If he doesn't care for the flesh, he'll never see it.
Look at that girl over to his left. Look over to your left, bookworm. There's a girl pining for you. A little further. Just a little further. There. Wasn't that worth looking for? See those nice store teeth all beaming at you. Why, she recognizes you. She's up. She's down. She can't make up her mind. She's up again. She recognizes you. She's coming over to speak to you. The suspense is killing me. Why, for heaven's sake, aren't you Fuzzy Oldhammer I went to manual training school with in Louisville? Oh, you're not? Well, you certainly look exactly like him. It's certainly a remarkable resemblance. But if you're not going to ask me to sit down, I suppose you're not going to ask me to sit down. I'm very sorry. I certainly hope I haven't caused you any embarrassment, you so-and-so. My tie's on straight. I certainly upset them, don't I? Now, who else is after me? Ah, the lady champion wrestler. Wouldn't she make a houseful? Well, you don't like her either. Well, what are you going to do about it? Oh, you just can't stand it anymore. You're leaving. These women don't give you a moment's peace, do they? Well, go ahead. Go sulk in your cabin. Go soak your head and see if I care.
Clowens continues, I would go so far as to say that the film in question is a Preston Sturgis movie, since the combination of her running remarks with more or less silent images replicates the widely touted method of narratage that Sturgis had claimed as the great innovation of The Power and the Glory. Close quote. These are just a few examples of the strange and interesting connections the author makes between Sturgis's work and the real world as he works his way through each film one by one. Also, by the way, in Sullivan's Travels, an earlier film by Sullivan, the character, mentioned in passing, has the actual title of Ants in Your Plants of 1939, which again, Mr. Clowens is almost unique in getting correctly. Crooked But Not Common is an excellent book, one of the best film books of the new year, and though he discusses the Palm Beach story, it is a pared-down version of the essay in Film as Philosophy, so interested readers are encouraged to track down that volume as well. Again, thanks for listening to Community Radio KBOO Portland. Film at 11 will be back next Friday, so until then, keep watching your screens.
This is Judy Berry from Earth First, and when I'm in Portland, I listen to non-commercial community radio, KBOO Portland. No compromise in defense of the truth.
KBOO's programming charter. KBOO should be a model of programming, filling needs that other media do not, providing programming to unserved or underserved groups. KBOO shall provide access and training to those communities. KBOO News and Public Affairs programming shall place an emphasis